Our fourth case for argument this morning is Wernzing against the Illinois Department of Human Services. Mr. Heller.
Thank you, Judge. My name is Brian Heller. I represent the plaintiff, Jenny Wernzing. The core issue of this case is the allocation of the burden of proof and the presumptions under the Equal Pay Act, and particularly the affirmative defense of a factor other than sex. Plaintiff was hired as an investigator for the Illinois Department of Human Services. It is undisputed that she presented a prima facie case that she started with the department and continuing to the date evidence was presented to the district court that she was paid substantially less than men that were performing exactly the same work. Ostensibly, plaintiff's initial salary was determined under a section of the state administrative code called the pay plan. But it is the position of the defendant on an appeal, and it certainly appears from the evidence, that in fact the pay plan was basically ignored. And that starting pay was determined by an automatic 10% pay increase from the employee's immediate prior occupation. And as long as the 10% pay increase kept you within the salary range that was set for the job of investigator. The Seventh Circuit has repeatedly stated that it is appropriate to consider prior compensation in setting the initial salary in a job, but has also warned repeatedly that undue reliance on prior compensation can be unlawful.
Is there any evidence in the record that the compensation patterns, please don't move the microphone, produces bad things in the recording. Is there any evidence in the record that the compensation in the prior jobs from which the Department of Human Services draws its staff reflects sex discrimination?
No, there is not. I mean, and that...
That's the worry we've expressed in these other cases. And if there's no reason to think that sex discrimination influenced the prior salaries, why would one be worried about carrying them over plus 10%?
Well, there's two reasons. First of all,
Maybe I should just finish.
Okay.
The reason I got to asking this is because your client, when she asked for a raise, said that the problem with this policy was that it discriminated against people who came to the agency from small or nonprofit employers, presumably men or women. It doesn't seem to have anything to do with sex. One wants to go back and see what the pattern of wages in hiring is.
Certainly, that was the impression that the plaintiff had. But the issue is, as I see it for the court, is on whom does the Equal Pay Act place the burden of demonstrating the fact that there isn't any discrimination in these prior pay patterns? And clearly, the burden of establishing affirmative defense under the Pay Act is the employer's burden, and certainly the employer who has much more the resources and the knowledge to establish that. The court intimated in one of its prior cases that the idea that you should have a discrimination case within a case, in other words, that the plaintiff had the burden to prove that their prior employer discriminated, was unworkable and not a burden that this court wanted to put on plaintiffs. Should also point out is that we're talking that the plaintiff here was employed by the Department of Human Services in just one pay grade or one category of worker as an investigator. The Department of Human Services apparently was applying the same policy to all of the employees it was hiring, again, contrary to state law, and it did not bring forth any evidence that in fact, that its policy over the whole department was non-discriminatory. The only evidence it produced was with respect to this particular job. Considering my the thought is that if this isn't a case where there is undue reliance on prior compensation, there is no such case. I mean, this is pure your prior compensation at your job, no matter what the job was, no matter what your experience was, no matter what your training was, that prior compensation is what will be used as the formula to determine your initial pay. So the issue is presented as clearly as it could be of undue reliance. And that
it is,
term...
It is, by the way, I don't know whether you know, it is, by the way the entire federal civil service works. There are pay ranges for federal jobs, and people are hired into them at their prior salary plus some increment. The entire federal civil service is organized that way, and by the way, the whole civil service and the judiciary is organized that way. Is it all just a rollicking violation of the Equal Pay Act?
Well, if I mean the Illinois law that they were supposed to be following allowed for such increases over prior pay, but didn't have a rigid formula that, in fact, it depended upon.
It's neither here nor there to us whether this is appropriate under Illinois law.
Well, that I think that fact at least goes to the question of whether this is being a bona fide. Approach by the employer if they're not if they're breaking the law in doing this, not following the very provisions that they're supposed to, then the question of whether this is a subterfuge or not certainly comes into question. If they don't bring forward a very plausible reason for not following the law that they're supposed to, and there was no plausible reason why the law was not being followed. Presented to the court. I am unfamiliar with the federal system and whether it's just a rigid formula based on prior salary. If in fact it is, it certainly would seem to raise questions based on the congressional finding that the labor markets have within them a structural deficiency that the Equal Pay Act was to address. If you simply wholesale adopt the existing market wage structure in setting your own wages, then you are perpetuating the disparities that are there. Now, you know, we can debate all day whether there, in fact, was the Congress right in deciding that there were disparities in the labor market, but that's not our role to determine whether the Congress was right. That was their finding, and clearly, as the Supreme Court recognized, the basis on which the act was adopted in the first place. And so, that's the very reason, it would seem to me, why this circuit and every other circuit that's addressed the issue that says there is a real problem with simply relying on prior compensation. And the defendants here did not provide any reason, either that for the male comparables that it was necessary to provide these pay increases to get them to take the job, or that there was even a general need in order to attract people generally to this investigatory position to provide these automatic pay increases. There is no such evidence in the record. So, and it is exactly that sort of evidence that this court, in its prior cases, in Riordan, in Day, in Cullen, has always pointed to the fact that the employer using the prior pay and either matching it or increasing it was necessary in order to get the person to change positions. If that doesn't matter, then all the precedent of this court was wasted in making that analysis. Here, that evidence simply does not exist. Now, the defendant has argued with the lapse of time that the court can simply assume that this disparity in the wage market is gone. It's provided no evidence of that. Again, we would argue that the burden is on the defendant to demonstrate its affirmative defense, and simply suggesting a hypothetical that the problem is gone is not enough. We've noted and asked the court to take judicial recognition that there is evidence, even from the President's Council of Economic Advisors, that this historical disparities still do exist. And finally, during the pendency of this...
Why would that be a topic of judicial notice?
Pardon?
Why would that be a topic of judicial notice? The extent and significance of wage disparities is a hotly contested issue in labor economics. Hardly seems the kind of indisputable thing that judges notice without evidence.
Well, the very fact that it is hot and disputed is simply all that I ask you to note, that in fact there is no overwhelming consensus that this disparity has gone away.
Look, what judicial notice is for things that are in beyond contest.
And it is beyond contest that the President's Economic Advising Council issued a report indicating that they saw that there's still a significant problem. That's all I ask you to recognize, that there is a significant body of evidence out there that there's still a problem, that it's hotly contested is fine too. I just suggesting that goes contrary to the defendant's argument that this historic disparity no longer exists. Finally, is during the pendency of this case, the state of Illinois has passed its own Equal Pay Act provision, and the state statute, and this was just either last year or the year before, provides for the state to engage in studies to determine what kind of pay disparities still exist. The Illinois Department of Labor's own website now requires posters saying that employers must put a poster up that says that women earn 71 cents for every dollar a man earns. Now, again, that's not proof of what the wage market is, but it certainly calls into the question, again, the good faith of the state in their argument that they can wholesale adopt the existing wage structure in setting their own wages and not provide any evidence that they're not discriminating in doing so. Finally, I would argue that the fact that the defendant is not following state law, and in their before the trial court four times switched their position as to exactly how they were setting the plaintiff's wages, is evidence of or at least raises a question of whether this is a bona fide defense. They don't even know and couldn't even argue to the district court exactly how they set the plaintiff's wages. At a minimum, these kind of facts should get the plaintiff to trial on the question of whether this pay plan or the policy of the defendant is bona fide and not a violation of the act. I would reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Keller. Mr. Light.
May it please the court, Eric Light, Assistant Attorney General on behalf of the Defendant Appellee, Illinois Department of Human Services. I'd like to begin by responding to one point that counsel made. He suggested that the department is arguing that due to the passage of time, there is no longer any wage disparity or, I suppose, maybe any discrimination. And that is not the department's position. The department is simply saying in this case that it is not appropriate to rely on 40-year-old congressional findings in
Does the department know, or does the record reflect what the male-female wage gap is in the lines of work from which the department draws its employees?
I think it's probably is possible to figure that out because there are tables that we included in our submissions in the summary judgment proceedings, which showed the people who came into the department, at least at the ISI 2 position, male and female, and what their salary increases were upon coming in.
That's not the question I asked.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I asked whether the record shows, obviously it doesn't, given your answer, whether the record shows the male-female wage difference in the line of business from which the department draws its employees. I wasn't asking questions about the particular wages of new hires.
I'm sorry, no, then there is not any evidence of that, Your Honor. The issue in this case is whether, based on this record, a rational jury could find that the department paid Ms. Wernsing less than certain male counterparts because she is a woman. The answer is no. The record contains no evidence that Wernsing's sex played any role in how the department set her salary. The department sought to establish the fourth affirmative defense that the Act provides, that the pay disparity at issue resulted from a factor other than sex. This is a broad catch-all exemption, which this Court has said encompasses virtually a limitless number of factors as long as they do not involve sex. The evidence in this case is the department set salaries of incoming ISI-2s based on its interpretation of the pay plan, which was that no one had to take a pay cut, that basically people started at the minimum of the salary range, and if that would require someone to take a pay cut, then they got up to a 10% salary increase. And the reason, of course, is that it's more likely to draw good candidates if you don't require people to take pay cuts. The record shows that the department applied this policy uniformly in this case. Ms. Wernsing's salary was well below the minimum of the salary range for ISI-2s. Therefore, she was accorded a 28.7% salary increase upon becoming an investigator. The five male comparables to which she points all had salaries well above the minimum, and therefore, under the department's interpretation of the pay plan, it would have been it would have had to lower their salary in order to paying them the minimum of the salary range would have forced them to take a pay cut, and therefore they were afforded salary increases of up to 10%.
It's my understanding that the record bears out that not every one of those employees got the 10%, though.
That's correct.
Some variation up to the 10%.
That's correct, and that's what Dolores Showalter, the DHS personnel, said, that they were entitled to raise up to 10%, not automatically 10%. The record shows that most people did get a 10% raise. For Goro, for example, one of the male comparables, he got a 1% raise. Part of that reason, I think, was because he misidentified his prior salary. But in any event, no one got more than a 10%. So there's no evidence that the department did not uniformly apply its interpretation of the pay plan. So at this point, having established that there is a gender-neutral factor that resulted in this pay disparity, the burden then shifted to Ms. Wernsing to place in dispute some material fact regarding this this factor. She could either show that it wasn't applied in a bona fide fashion, that it was discriminatorily applied, or this court has indicated that perhaps if it had a discriminatory effect, it might. She might be able to present a question of fact for trial. Her main argument seems to be that the policy had a discriminatory effect, and she argues based on the 1963 findings that Congress made when enacting the Equal Pay Act. She urges, based on those findings of widespread discrimination against women, that this court should presume in this case that the department's use of prior salary resulted in her being discriminated against. Of course, the court doesn't have to rely on any presumptions in this case because there's evidence in the record. The department submitted Ms. Wernsing's letter where she requested a salary adjustment in which she herself attributed her lower salary to the fact that she worked for a small organization with a small budget that could not afford to pay higher salaries. And indeed, she was in a position to know the financial position of her organization because for a while she had a supervisory position which she indicated she was responsible for budgeting of official funds. So presumably she would be in a position to know that it wasn't due to discrimination. And indeed, she never claimed discrimination until she filed this lawsuit. In addition, the record shows that One of the reasons why Ms. Wernsing's salary at her prior employer was low was because she voluntarily gave up that supervisory position and thereby took a pay cut. So this goes to show that not everyone who has a low prior salary has that necessarily because of sex discrimination by the prior employer. Things like the financial resources of the organization and personal choices of the individuals are explanations, and they're explanations in this case. Ms. Morrison claims that she raised a question of fact regarding the good faith application of the policy. She says the department deviated from its regulations by giving an automatic 10% raise without any documenting support of the qualifications that would justify going above the minimum. And she says that the department went above the midpoint of the first half of the salary range without getting prior approval of CMS. I would submit that these, to the extent they're violations, are minor violations that do not raise the specter of bad faith on the part of the department. Ms. Wernsing does not argue, she does not show that any person who received above the minimum salary, minimum of the salary range, did not in fact possess the requisite qualifications. And in fact, the record shows that CMS did approve the higher salaries of the five male comparables. In any event, the question is not whether the department followed state law. The question really is whether the department applied its policy unevenly or in some discriminatory fashion, and there's no evidence of that in this case. Indeed, as a result of this policy, there are many female investigators who earn more than a lot of the male investigators, and that too is in the record. It's in the tables that we submitted, exhibits to document 29. In sum, the department's reliance on prior salary is a factor other than sex. Ms. Wernsing presented no evidence that it was applied discriminatorily in bad faith or that it somehow perpetuated historic gender discrimination. If the court has any other questions, we ask that the court affirm the judgment of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. White. Anything further, Mr. Heller?
Yes.
First, I would point out that the violations of the pay plan were consistent and not minor. The testimony was the pay plan envisions that every employee will start at the minimum of the range unless it is documented that they have experience and training that would justify going further, and it was clear that absolutely none of that was done from the record, that there was simply a formula that was applied so that, in fact, it's not minor. The pay plan was simply ignored. Secondly, as far as there being no evidence in the record that would justify our claim. We went through in our reply brief on page 13 and pointed out the difference between the plaintiff and male comparable Brad Davis, who started the job 2 years after Ms. Wernsing, earning almost 20% more. So she had 2 years of experience, he had 8 years of experience in law enforcement compared to her 13 years, and his 8 years was as a correctional officer. Now, I throw out the hypothetical that the possibility that the correctional officer field and the nature of that job is such that it pays higher and that males tend to dominate in that position, and that could well suggest why he started a job 20% higher than hers after her pay after she had 2 years of experience in the job. And this is exactly the type of disparity that the Equal Pay Act was intended to address. And also note that the defendant has shown from its tables that maybe on average that the women in this investigatory position are not being discriminated against, but there's a very small sample of 20-30 individuals in 2 years and proves very little. For all these reasons, we would ask that the judgment of the district court be reversed and the case be remanded. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The case is taken under advisement.